This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of distal femur fractures from the trauma section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Distal femur fractures are traumatic injuries involving the region extending from the distal metaphyseal-diaphyseal junction to the articular surface of the femoral condyles. Diagnosis is made radiographically, with CT studies often required to assess for intra-articular extension. Treatment is generally operative with ORIF, intramedullary nail, or distal femur replacement, depending on available bone stock, age of the patient, and patient activity demands. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, the incidence of distal femur fracture is common, and they make up 3-6% of femur fractures, but less than 1% of all fractures. In terms of demographics, there's a bimodal distribution for distal femur fractures, that is, young, healthy males, and elderly osteopenic females. Moving on to the pathophysiology, the mechanism of distal femur fractures in young patients is typically high energy with significant displacement, while in older patients it is low energy, often a fall from standing, an osteoporotic bone, and usually with a lesser degree of displacement. Now let's talk about some relevant anatomy. We'll go over osteology, muscles, ligaments, and biomechanics. So starting with osteology of the distal femur, the anatomical axis of the distal femur is 6 to 11 degrees of valgus. Note that the medial condyle extends more distal than the lateral condyle. Remember that the distal femur becomes trapezoidal in cross-section towards the knee. The lateral cortex of the femur slopes approximately 10 degrees, and the medial cortex slopes approximately 25 degrees in the axial plane. The posterior halves of both condyles are posterior to the posterior cortex of the femoral shaft. In terms of muscles, the key deforming forces on the distal femur include the quadriceps, hamstrings, adductor magnus, and gastrocnemius. The ligaments include the anterior cruciate ligament, or ACL, the posterior cruciate ligament, or PCL, the medial collateral ligament, or MCL, and the lateral collateral ligament, or the LCL. As far as biomechanics, the hamstring and quadriceps cause the femur to shorten. The adductor magnus leads to distal femoral varus, or valgus. The direction of the deformity is dependent on the location of comminution and the relation of the fracture lines to the adductor tubercle. Finally, as far as the gastrocnemius, this leads to extension at the fracture site, or apex posterior, as well as rotation of the condyles when an intracondylar split is present. Now, let's talk about the classification of distal femur fractures, and the ones to know include the descriptive classification and the OTA classification. The descriptive classification is basically divided into two types: supracondylar and intracondylar. The OTA classification of the distal femur corresponds to region 33, and this is divided into three types. A is extra-articular, B is partial articular, and C is complete articular. With respect to B, or partial articular, a portion of the articular surface remains in continuity with the shaft. Note that a 33B3 is in the coronal plane, otherwise known as the Hoffa fragment. And a 33C, or a complete articular distal femur fracture, has the articular fragment separated from the shaft. Moving on to the presentation of distal femur fractures, as far as history, patients commonly present after a fall or traumatic event. As far as symptoms, common symptoms include pain of the distal femur that is made worse with knee movement and an inability to weight bear. Moving on to physical exam, inspection may reveal tenderness, swelling, and ecchymosis of the distal thigh and knee. There will also be varus or valgus deformity. Knee effusion may be present with intra-articular involvement, and be sure to evaluate for wounds concerning for an open fracture. Keep in mind that this can occur in 5 to 10% of supracondylar fractures. Moving on to neurovascular exam, with respect to vascular evaluation, there is potential for injury to the popliteal artery if there is significant displacement in a distal femur fracture. An ankylobrachial index, or ABI, should be performed if there is a concern for vascular injury. Angiography is indicated if less than 0.9, greater than 0.9 equals 99% negative predictive value, and less than 0.9 equals 97% specific and 95% sensitive for major arterial injury. Moving on to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include an AP and a lateral. Additional views can include a traction view, views of the adjacent joints, and the contralateral femur. Traction views should include an AP, lateral, and oblique traction view, which can help characterize the injury but are painful for the patient. As far as views of the adjacent joints, obtain imaging of the entire femur to rule out associated injuries. In terms of the contralateral femur, consider views of the contralateral femur for preoperative planning and templating. As far as findings on radiographs, it can be difficult to visualize intra-articular extension. Note that the condyles can be malrotated in the sagittal plane with respect to each other. A sagittal intra-articular split is most common. Finally, a Hoffa fracture is an intra-articular distal femoral fracture in the coronal plane. There's a 38% incidence. This is seen on the lateral view. It's missed in up to 31% of cases, and lateral condyle fractures have an 80% incidence. In elderly patients, be sure to evaluate for any pre-existing knee degenerative joint disease. Moving on to CT scan, this is indicated for preoperative planning, evaluating intra-articular involvement, and should be done after external fixation to assess pattern, comminution, and intra-articular extension. Findings include separate osteochondral fragments in the area of the intracondylar notch. Other findings on CT can include a coronal plane fracture, otherwise known as a Hoffa fracture, seen in 40% of patients, and a lateral femoral condyle fracture in 80% of patients. Moving on to angiography, this is indicated in the setting of an ankle brachial index or ABI of less than 0.9. As far as obvious signs of vascular injury, there are hard and soft signs, for example, pulselessness, rapidly expanding hematoma, massive bleeding, etc. In terms of findings on angiography, these studies identify vascular segments with diminished flow. In terms of vascular injury, again, displaced distal femur fractures may result in injury to the popliteal artery. Now let's talk about treatment for distal femur fractures, which can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes a hinged knee brace. The indications are rare, but can be used in the setting of stable non-displaced fractures, a non-ambulatory patient, and patients with significant comorbidities presenting with an unacceptably high degree of surgical/anesthetic risk. Outcomes are variable and dependent on multiple factors, including patient characteristics and fracture pattern. Operative options include external fixation, open reduction internal fixation, or ORIF, retrograde intramedullary nail, as well as arthroplasty and distal femoral replacement. External fixation is indicated as a temporizing measure to restore length, alignment, and stability. This is used in an unstable polytrauma patient, when soft tissues are not amenable to surgical incisions and internal fixation, or until the patient is stable, and it's also indicated when there's contamination requiring multiple debridements. Definitive treatment includes severe open and or comminuted fractures, as well as patients unstable for surgery. Outcomes of external fixation are variable and dependent on multiple factors including patient characteristics, fracture pattern, and degree of soft tissue injury. There are 92 to 100% union rates reported at an average of 4 to 6 months when used as a definitive treatment. Moving on to open reduction internal fixation, or ORIF, indications include displaced fractures, intra-articular fractures, and note that traditional 95-degree devices are contraindicated in Hoffa fractures. Other indications include periprosthetic fractures with osteoporotic bone, non-unions, and note that fixed-angle plates are required for metaphyseal comminution. Non-fixed-angle plates are prone to varus collapse. In terms of outcomes of open reduction internal fixation, this is variable and dependent on multiple factors including patient characteristics and fracture pattern. Note that there are non-union rates of up to 18% after ORIF. A retrograde intramedullary nail is indicated for extra-articular fractures, simple intra-articular fractures, periprosthetic fractures with implants with an open box design. Note that distal femoral replacements do not allow retrograde nail fixation. And know that traditionally 4 centimeters of intact distal femur is needed, but newer implants with very distal interlocking options may decrease this number. You can also use independent screw stabilization of intra-articular components placed around the nail. As far as outcomes of retrograde intramedullary nailing, this is variable and dependent on multiple factors including patient characteristics and fracture pattern. There are high union rates reported, and there is more symmetric callus formation compared to plates. There are reduced rates of malunion and higher patient satisfaction compared to ORIF that have been reported. Finally, moving on to arthroplasty and distal femoral replacement, arthroplasty is indicated for pre-existing osteoarthritis with an amenable fracture pattern. A distal femoral replacement is indicated in low-demand patients that have unreconstructable fractures, fractures around a prior total knee arthroplasty with a loose component, and/or in the setting of a low-demand patient with osteoarthritis. Outcomes of arthroplasty and distal femoral replacement in the setting of a distal femur fracture are variable and dependent on multiple factors including patient characteristics and fracture pattern. These patients may have improved ambulatory status and decreased non-union compared to other methods of fixation. However, there is reduced longevity compared with internal fixation, but arthroplasty and distal femoral replacement allows immediate weight bearing. Now, let's talk about some of these management techniques in a bit more detail. So starting with a hinged knee brace, this technique involves full-time bracing for 6 to 8 weeks, Closed chain range of motion exercises are done at 3 to 4 weeks. Restricted weight bearing is prescribed until there's evidence of fracture union, and serial radiographs are obtained to assess for displacement. Complications can include wounds from immobilization and bracing, as well as knee stiffness. Moving on to external fixation, as far as the technique, avoid pin placement in the area of planned plate placement if possible. Complications include pin tract infections. Moving on to open reduction internal fixation, or ORIF, the approach can be lateral or a minimally invasive lateral modified anterior or swashbuckler approach. You can use a lateral parapatellar approach, a medial parapatellar approach, a medial approach, or a medial slash lateral posterior approach. So a lateral approach is suitable for all fracture types. You will use an arthrotomy for direct reduction of articular components. Moving on to the minimally invasive lateral modified anterior or swashbuckler approach, this is best when used for extra-articular fractures. You will use a distal incision large enough to insert a plate submuscularly. Screws are placed through smaller proximal incisions. There will be a midline anterior incision that angles slightly lateral. You will use a lateral parapatellar arthrotomy, and this approach facilitates articular and lateral distal femur exposure. A lateral parapatellar approach can be used for fractures with complex articular extension. You can extend the incision into the quadriceps tendon to evert the patella, and this can be used for a Hoffa fracture. A medial parapatellar approach is used for complex medial femoral condyle fractures. A medial approach is most often used for B2 and B3 patterns, and it can be used to augment fixation with a medial plate in type C3 patterns. Finally, in terms of a medial slash lateral posterior approach, this is used for very posterior Hoffa fragment fixation. The patient is placed in the prone position. You will use a midline incision over the popliteal fossa and then develop a plane between the medial and lateral gastrocnemius, and then a capsulotomy will be done to visualize the fracture. As far as the technique for ORIF, the goals include anatomic joint reduction with rigid fixation, and be sure to restore the articular surface before fixation of the extra-articular component. Other goals include a stable fixation of the articular component to the diaphysis for early range of motion and preservation of vascularity. Keep in mind the direct visualization of the joint allows perfect reduction of intra-articular fractures with lag screw fixation before attaching the articular block to the proximal fragment. Note that Hoffa fragments can be captured with an anterior to posterior screw. As far as locking plates, these allow better control of the coronal plate compared to 95-degree angled blade plates and dynamic condylar screws. Multiplane screw trajectory allows fixation of a coronal or Hoffa fragments. You can also use lag screws with lock screws, which is a hybrid construct. This can be used for intracondylar fractures, usually in conjunction with a locked plate, or for coronal plane fractures. Locking screw constructs don't rely on bone plate contact for stability. This is helpful when pre-contoured plates do not precisely match patient anatomy. Remember that there is a potential to create too stiff of a construct leading to non-union or plate failure. Also know that locking plates are not an appropriate construct for isolated medial femoral condyle fractures. A non-fixed angle plate has a risk of varus malalignment and has a high risk with metaphyseal comminution. Blade plate fixation requires precise initial implantation of the blade into the distal fragment. This is contraindicated in type C3 fractures and may provide poor fixation for osteoporotic bone. Finally, as far as dynamic condylar screws, precise sagittal plane alignment is not necessary as the plate rotates around the barrel. A large amount of bone is removed with this option and may provide poor fixation in osteoporotic bone. Complications of ORIF include non-union and knee stiffness. Moving on to a retrograde intramedullary nail, the approach can be a transtendon approach or a medial parapatellar approach. The transtendon approach is a mid-substance longitudinal patellar tendon split. A medial parapatellar approach, you will use a 2.5 centimeter incision parallel to the medial aspect of the patellar tendon and no attempt to visualize the articular surface if there is no articular extension. If there is articular extension present, continue the approach 2 to 8 centimeters cephalad. You will then incise the extensor mechanism 10 millimeters medial to the patella. Eversion of the patella is not typically necessary, and you need to stabilize articular segments before nail placement. As far as the surgical technique for a retrograde intramedullary nail, insertion requires greater than or equal to 70 degrees of knee flexion. Remember, articular reduction and fixation should be done before nail placement. Know that lag screws are placed out of the intended intramedullary nail path. The starting point is at the superior margin of Blumensaad's line on the lateral and the center of the intracondylar notch on the AP. Blocking screws facilitate reduction and strengthen the construct. Short nails are rarely indicated. Remember that the implant should reach the lesser trochanter to reduce the risk of vascular injury. Complications of a retrograde intramedullary nail include postoperative knee pain. An intramedullary nail for periprosthetic fractures may result in a recurvatum deformity. The box design requires a posterior starting point. Finally, moving on to arthroplasty and distal femoral replacement, the approach is an extensile anterior, lateral, or medial approach. However, you should use a previous scar if possible. The technique will involve resecting the fracture to allow full weight bearing. Complications include mechanical failure, which can be secondary to endoprosthetic metal or polyethylene component failure, aseptic loosening, modular component dissociation, as well as polyethylene wear synovitis. Finally, let's end this review session talking about some complications. The ones to know include knee pain slash stiffness, symptomatic hardware, malunions, non-unions, infection, implant failure, and loss of fixation. So knee pain slash stiffness is treated with early range of motion and physical therapy. Moving on to symptomatic hardware, risk factors include a lateral plate and medial screw placement. If a plate is placed laterally, there may be pain with knee flexion slash extension due to the IT band in contact with the plate. In the setting of medial screw placement, excessively long screws can irritate medial soft tissues. Be sure to determine appropriate intercondylar screw length by obtaining an AP radiograph of the knee with the leg internally rotated 30 degrees. Treatment for symptomatic hardware is hardware removal. Moving on to malunions, as far as risk factors, common deformities after plating include rotation, hyperextension or recurvatum, and coronal malalignment. A quote-unquote golf club deformity arises from medial translation of the articular block when the plate is placed too posterior distally. Percutaneous submuscular fixation with pre-contoured locking plate is another risk factor and often causes rotational malalignment. Keep in mind that malalignment is more common with intramedullary nails. Treatment of malunions is a revision internal fixation with osteotomy, and keep in mind that functional results are satisfactory if the malalignment is within 5 degrees in any plane. Moving on to non-unions, the incidence is up to 19% and is most commonly in the metaphyseal area with the articular portion healed. Comminution, bone loss, and open fractures are more likely in the metaphysis. Risk factors for non-unions are associated with soft tissue stripping in the metaphyseal region. As far as treatment for non-unions, revision ORIF and autograft is indicated. Consider changing the fixation technique to improve biomechanics. Moving on to infection, risk factors include diabetics with foot ulcers. Treatment includes debridement, culture-specific antibiotics, and hardware removal if fracture stability permits. As far as implant failure, the incidence is up to 9%. Risk factors include improper bridge plating techniques, a short working length construct, and know that stainless steel implants may be inferior to titanium. Finally, in terms of loss of fixation, varus collapse is the most common. Plate fixation is associated with toggling of the distal non-fixed angle screws used for comminuted metaphyseal fractures. Varus collapse can also be seen with intramedullary nail fixation. Finally, know that proximal diaphyseal screw failure is associated with short plates and non-locked diaphyseal fixation. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply this information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, what is a known risk factor for lateral distal femoral locking plate failure when used for the fixation of comminuted extra-articular fractures? And the choices are 1. Early postoperative knee range of motion, 2. Delayed weight bearing, 3. Short working length of the construct, 4. Bridge plate fixation, and 5. Plate screw density less than 0.5. The correct answer to this question is 3. Short working length of the construct. So of the options given, a short working length of the construct is a known risk factor for femoral plate failure. Implant failure is common in distal femur fractures stabilized with plate fixation. Contributors to failure include a short working length of the construct, plate screw density more than 0.5, and short plate lengths. This will lead to failure as it causes increased strain on the plate over a short segment and does not allow enough motion at the fracture site to form bone for healing by secondary intention. Ricci et al. Reviewed 355 cases of distal femur plate fixation. 64 patients, or 19%, required reoperation to promote union, including 30 that had a planned staged bone grafting. Risk factors for proximal implant failure included open fracture, smoking, increased body mass index, and shorter plate length. Krieger et al. Reviewed 119 patients with distal femoral plate fixation. They found that 93% fractures healed without acute bone grafting. Complications included 5 losses of proximal fixation, 2 non-unions, and 3 acute infections. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, Answer 1, early postoperative knee range of motion is incorrect, as early postoperative knee range of motion has not been associated with failure of this construct. Answer 2, delayed weight bearing is incorrect, as early weight bearing can actually put too much force across the plate, causing fatigue failure of the plate. Answer 4, bridge plate fixation is incorrect, as bridge plate fixation would have been the proper technique to use in this situation. And finally, answer 5, plate screw density less than 0.5 is incorrect, as plate screw density less than 0.5 would have been the proper technique to use in this situation, and this would have helped to avoid this complication. And moving on to the final question. During surgical treatment of the most common variation of distal femoral Hoffa fractures, which of the following orientations for screw fixation should be used? And the choices are 1, medial to lateral screw placement across lateral femoral condyle, 2, anterior to posterior screw placement across the medial femoral condyle, 3, medial to lateral screw placement across the medial femoral condyle, 4, anterior to posterior screw placement across the lateral femoral condyle, and 5, anterior to posterior screw placement across the intercondylar notch. The correct answer to this question is 4, anterior to posterior screw placement across the lateral femoral condyle. So the most common variation of a Hoffa fracture is a coronal fracture of the lateral femoral condyle. The most appropriate screw placement of the choices given in the treatment of the most common Hoffa fracture variant would be anterior to posterior screws across the lateral condyle for fixation. Hoffa fractures are coronally oriented fractures of the femoral condyles, with most occurring in the lateral condyle. They are commonly associated with high-energy fractures of the distal femur and can often be overlooked during the assessment and treatment of distal femur fractures. Hoffa fractures are best evaluated using CT scans. Nork et al. Studied the association of supracondylar-intercondylar distal femoral fractures and coronal plane fractures. Of 202 supracondylar-intercondylar distal femoral fractures, they found coronal plane fractures were diagnosed in 38%. A coronal fracture of the lateral femoral condyle was involved more frequently than the medial condyle. 85% of these coronal fractures involved a single lateral femoral condyle. Holmes et al. Looked at 5 cases of coronal fractures of the femoral condyle. All cases received open reduction and internal fixation with lag screws through a formal parapatellar approach. They reported good results, with all fractures healing within 12 weeks without complications, with final range of motion at least 0 degrees to 115 degrees. That's all for this review about distal femur fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.